Four decades ago, an unknown composer pushing 40 finally got his big break, a premiere at the establishment venue, the Metropolitan Opera House. But this opera didn't really have a plot, it was 4.5 hours long, and it drove a lot of listeners crazy. And with that, Philip Glass had the world's attention.
Look, I wasn't willing to drive a taxi for the rest of my life.
Which you did into your 40s.
Into my 40s.
Yeah. Today in Studio 360, I talk with Philip Glass, probably the best-known orchestral composer working today. And we have a winner in our DJ Rupture Remix Challenge. We gave you the musical raw materials, and you wove them into your own tapestries. I'm Kurt Anderson. All that and more is ahead this hour in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. A few weeks ago, we started an experiment with the cutting-edge musician who goes by the name DJ Rupture. He gave you all the recorded components to one of his songs and challenged you to remix it at will. Dozens of you accepted that challenge. Later in the hour, DJ Rupture picks the winning remix. But first, for the last century or so, there's been a perpetual debate in the culture about what art is. And the upshot has been that the definition has gotten broader and broader. Now the highest court in the state of New York is deciding whether the dancers in a strip club are, legally, for purposes of tax law, any different from serious dancers in any theater, Lincoln Center ballets, off-Broadway theaters, wherever. The lawyer for the strip club in the case, Night Moves versus the State of New York, is here with me now. Andrew McCullough, welcome.
Thank you.
So give me and the listeners who aren't as familiar with the story your one-minute version of your argument.
Well, there's an admission tax to a place of amusement, but exempt from that tax or excluded from that tax is choreographed dance performances. And we figure that we are choreographed dance performances, and we hadn't been paying taxes. And then a couple of years ago, a state auditor walks in and he says, "That's not really dancing. That's not really choreography. Pay us a lot of money." And we said, "No, we think that we are." And we hired a PhD expert, the expert in the field, to testify at the hearing that this was, in fact, choreographed dance performance, and she did a fine job, and the administrative law judge for the tax department found in our favor. The state appealed, and then we appealed, and here we are.
And that expert witness, who is Judith mm-hmm. Hanna, who's 70-something years old, and as you say, has a PhD from Columbia, and is an established author and critic of dance. What was her her basic argument was where you won in the lower court, essentially, was what?
She testified to simple things like, for instance, that the former choreographer for the New York Ballet Company used to like to go to watch exotic dancers from time to time to pick up some ideas for moves.
Right. Balanchine went in to see strippers in Paris, essentially.
Yes. We submitted some videos of the girls dancing. You know, they use the pole. You've heard certainly of pole dancing.
I've heard of it, yes.
It's a different type of dancing than you would find in the Bolshoi Ballet, as one of the judges said. But nevertheless, it's artistic, it's creative, and she watched a girl dance, and she charted out 62 different moves that the girl made. And it takes a while. You cannot get on that pole and do what those girls do without a lot of work.
Well,
and this is not a case of just, you know, like the New York Ballet Company. You know, suppose there's a musical theater and they don't have the money for a professional choreographer, and they work out their moves the best they can. where is the line?
Right. I do wonder how in this day and age these judges are gonna make that distinction. Are you hopeful that the way that modern dance has broadened to encompass all kinds of things, including nudity, is going to help you?
Yes, I am. I just don't know, you know, that you can say, well, you know, this is something we just don't approve of. And maybe you can, but if you do, you have to be the legislature to do it.
And clearly, I mean, we don't need to be coy. The dancers in Night Moves in upstate New York are doing something different in intent than the dancers at the American Ballet Theatre. But you're just saying the law doesn't make that distinction.
No, the law doesn't make that distinction. And certainly at least a couple of the judges on the Court of Appeals were well aware of that. I wouldn't say that it's going to be a unanimous decision, but I would say we're going to get a majority.
And will this be an important precedent should you win?
I think that the important part of it is that it's an acknowledgement that, you know, exotic dancing can in fact be an art form.
Is this kind of case a big part of your practice ordinarily?
Well, I represent adult businesses to a substantial degree, yes.
And you also, I was interested to discover, are an active libertarian and indeed the libertarian candidate for attorney general in Utah.
I was hoping you'd mention that. You know, certainly I feel like one of the most important things is to protect our freedoms. And I do it in the courtroom every day. But then you get to the point where you say, it's not enough. And Eugene Debs, who ran for president as a socialist many years ago, was asked why he kept doing it even though he knew he was going to lose. And he said, I'm trying to change the nature of the debate. And so I do what I can to preach the philosophy, whether it be in a courtroom or on a stump.
And you do it from Utah, which is, I could imagine, a state where defending a strip club and other adult businesses might not go over so well.
Well, Utah is less than free, let's put it, and they need enlightenment, and I figure that I've got another 10 years or so to work on giving it to them, and that's my life's work.
Great.
Well, then I want to retire to New York where I have a summer home and write my memoirs.
Oh, there you go. Andrew McCullough, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And your pride's a dancer for money. Do what you want me to do. I'm your private dancer for money. Any old music will.
The New York State Court of Appeals, the highest court in New York, is expected to deliver a decision on the artistic nature of stripping later this fall. Tell us what you think at studio360.org. Coming up, Philip Glass has written operas about Einstein and Gandhi, and now another visionary, an American, Walt Disney.
He said 50 years from now, which is now, young people may not know that there was a guy named Walt Disney that they'll think it's just a company. One of the big themes is about the immortality of art and the mortality of the artist.
The composer Philip Glass, that's coming up in just a minute in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
When you wish upon a star, make no difference who you are. Anything your heart desires will come
. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. For the last 50 years, the composer Philip Glass has been creating symphonies, operas, chamber music, and he's redefined the sound of a lot of advertising on TV and movies, too, like this score for The Hours. All year long, Glass has been honored with nonstop concerts and lectures to mark his 75th birthday. Turns out it's exhausting being a celebrated icon.
And the thing is that I mistakenly, or cleverly, whatever it might have been, I kept the same writing schedule as if it was a normal year,
yeah.
Which meant that I had a hell of a full year.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I was thinking just today, it's nice to be, I had to work so hard this year that I didn't have any time to think about slowing down.
And also this year, a new production of Einstein on the Beach is touring the world. That is the opera directed by Robert Wilson that made Philip Glass a household name. Philip Glass, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you, Colonel. Pleased to be here.
At last, since I have been a fan of your music for my entire adulthood. And I feel like we should have met by now, but here we are.
Well, it's good. Better late than never.
So, Einstein on the Beach. Do you remember the first time you became interested in Albert Einstein?
Yes, I do, because it was a momentous event in my life. It was I was born in 37, so in 1945, I was 8 years old.
And you were basically growing up during World War II.
It was
coming
during World War.
To consciousness.
Oh, we saw when you went to the movies on Saturday for maybe 25 cents, you saw the newsreels. And after the war, suddenly the huge interest in Einstein began about then, 1946, because people began wondering, how did this happen? What does it mean? And suddenly, there was a tremendous interest in science. And I grew up in Baltimore, which had a wonderful public library called the Enoch Pratt Library. My mother, by the way, was a librarian by profession, was a teacher and librarian. So that we all had library cards when we were kids. And every Friday, we went to the library and got our books out for the week. And at the library, they had talks and presentations and guest speakers about Einstein.
And then as you were growing up and becoming a teenager, he was in the United States and becoming more and more celebrated.
We would call him today a rock star.
Let's listen to a little bit of Einstein on the Beach. Now, if any of our listeners are wondering what the words are, they're simply saying in that section, 1, 2, 3.
1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah, that's right. And I was just listening to it, Kurt, and was thinking that if it had been written 35 years ago, if someone turned up with that piece today, it would sound absolutely new.
Which speaks to the fact that not much has advanced in 35 years?
Well, let's put it this way. I think, in fact, that spirit of experimental work is still around. The generation of avant-garde music that preceded my generation had kind of... They were satisfied with obscurity in a way that none of us could imagine.
That's interesting. So you feel that it was... I mean, I think of, well, a wider world plucked you avant-gardists out of obscurity, but you're suggesting that it was you avant-gardists who wanted...
You wanted
to be big time.
We were the third or fourth generation by then.
Yeah.
And
obscurity was not something you were willing to...
Well, look, I wasn't willing to drive a taxi for the rest of my life.
Which you did into your 40s.
Into my 40s.
Yeah. Well, and you essentially are you and Robert Wilson and others are the last avant-garde generation for whom that's possible. I mean, it seems as though the idea of the avant-garde became a null set at a certain point.
I think that's true. There's another odd thing about, there's a peculiar thing about Einstein, which I've just noticed recently. When I was talking with a tabla player from India about this, and we were talking about the structure of music. I worked for Ravi Shankar for a long time and studied with him, because to work with him is to study with him. There's no difference, really. And that had a big impact on my music.
I would think the biggest.
Nadia Boulanger, who was also was...
With whom you studied piano in
France. I studied composition and harmony and counterpoint. I was with him at the same time, actually. This was in the mid-60s.
And to give listeners a flavor of that crucible, let's play a little bit of Nadia Boulanger on piano, followed by Ravi Shankar on the sitar.
But the point is that the rhythmic structure of Indian music is based on the idea of binary music. It's like ones and zeros. Instead of ones and zeros, they use twos and threes. But it's basically the same idea of you can have an endless stream of information with two integers, really. So Einstein came, I see, that was written 10 years after I completed my studies with them, and I spent 10 years developing a language which integrated this kind of binary way of thinking with traditional harmony. Now, when you're listening to that piece, what you're hearing is binary music. So is it possible that I was anticipated, not I did, but...
The digital revolution?
Well, I would say it wasn't me. I would say that the global music had anticipated
That
I learned it from India. But I could have learned it from Africa also.
Well, it's interesting. Now that you say, Nadia Boulanger and Ravi Shankar were my great influences, it's almost like an equation. Nadia Boulanger plus Ravi Shankar equals Philip Glass.
That's right. In fact, I often describe the experience of that year. I said it was like having two angels on my shoulder, one on the right shoulder, one in the right ear, one in the left ear. And he said one taught through love and one taught through fear.
I assume Boulanger was the fear.
Everyone does, and actually that's correct. and yet, in the end, the methodology mattered not as much as the content.
You once said that you, quote, had the ability to write music that was so radical that I could be mistaken for an idiot, and it absolutely didn't bother me. What did people find idiotic 50 years ago?
Oh, there was a lot of repetition.
Yeah, well, we know that. Yeah, well, and that was just like, well, what is it? That's all he knows how to do is repeat.
You either could hear it or you couldn't. Yeah. But it's like, I remember when I first walked into the Museum of Modern Art and saw a painting of Frank Stella's, I didn't know what the hell it was. The language, I was used to abstract expressionists, I was used to Pollock and Gustin and all these guys, and suddenly there was someone working in a different way, and I was totally shocked. And I think it's the shock of a new language. And that can paralyze you at first. However, I had learned from my father, actually, that familiarity can breed love, not contempt, it breeds love.
I started listening to your music in my 20s on my Walkman and fell in love with it. And then one of the things that kept me interested during the 1980s and then into the 90s was that you changed. You weren't just doing the same thing over and over. And the music became more lyrical, romantic, melodic, accessible,
All of those things. All kinds of things.
For instance, I want to play a little bit of your symphony Heroes from 1996. How conscious was that transformation from Philip Glass Phase 1 to Philip Glass Phase 2?
It was very conscious because when I had my I had met Ravi Shankar and Annette Boulanger at the same time, and that was the beginning of an experiment in musical language that produced, finally, Einstein. Einstein was actually the end of that 10-year period. It wasn't the beginning. The beginning of the next period was Satyagraha, which doesn't at all sound like Einstein. So I said, okay, that I did that, and now that music didn't exactly go away. It became part of my my musical resource, but it wasn't something that I felt compelled to reproduce.
And the change you think was motivated by, oh, I just want to do something new, or people like this
just curiosity.
Yeah,
my public didn't noticeably change for a long time, though there were a lot of people that came to the Met. But it was hardly an overnight success after that. It was another 10 years before. These days the concerts sell out, but it was a long time before that was a fait accompli.
Is it true you are now engaged in writing an opera about Walt Disney?
It is true.
And do you what's your big idea about Mr. Disney?
He's a very interesting guy. He's a man who had a vision that became global. I mean, it's
hard to think of a more influential person.
But the thing that's really interesting, it was about the death of Disney, really. It was about the last 3 months of his life. And the conflicts that he has about dying and thinking, and at one point he says, he said 50 years from now, which is now, actually, young people may not know that there was a guy named Walt Disney that they'll think is just a company. So the one that pained him at the same time, he would also say, well, the thing that will last will be Disney. So in a way, one of the big themes is about the immortality of art and the mortality of the artist.
Will you make any musical references to Disney music?
Oh, I don't think so. No, I can't make any visual ones either. I mean, the property, the artistic property belongs to the Disney company. There's no question about that. The man, I think he was an amazing American. It's not a whitewash either. The more you find out about a person, the more the humanness of it becomes very moving. To me, that's what the story is. When we elevate our artists and our geniuses beyond the human level, we lose something. This is a work of fiction. This is not a documentary. I mean, it's not. Opera is above all, it's poetry. When people go to Einstein, they're not going to walk away understanding
the biography of.
No, they won't understand the biography of Einstein.
Or the nature of physics.
And they won't. But what they will see, they will see some of the things that Einstein thought about, which Bob Wilson was able to translate into images.
I look forward, and Philip Glass, thank you very much for coming in today.
Very pleased to be here, Kurt.
Philip Glass's opera Einstein on the Beach is on stage at the Brooklyn Academy of Music in New York City this month. And at our website, you can watch a video of the cast performing Einstein on the Beach. That's at studio360.org. And while you're there, for all you Philip Glass completists, you can also hear my full uncut interview with Glass. That's studio360.org. Around the time that Philip Glass and his peers were shaking up classical music, another musical revolution was starting in pop. Hip-hop pioneers using the turntable to remix songs in real time. A couple generations later, you get somebody like Jace Clayton, also known as DJ Rupture. He is a turntable wizard, as well as an ethnomusicologist and a bit of a philosopher. When he was on the show a few weeks ago, he was good enough to give us one of his band's tracks for you to remix. This is the original song called L'Avion, or The Plane. Guys, 70 of you, came back with 70 different remixes that ranged hugely in style and texture, from experimental collages to house beats. And now it is time for the man himself, DJ Rupture, to pick a winner from among all of your entries. Jace Clayton, welcome back to Studio 360.
Hello, thanks.
So, first, let me ask you, in a general sense, what makes a good remix?
I'm always looking for a remix which really reimagines the source material, and so it needs to be a little disrespectful. It needs to break it down to pieces and then build it up into a totally, you know, a new shape.
Uh-huh.
I want to be surprised, because I know the original song inside and out.
Yeah.
And so remixes will just change a few details here and there. I find that a little bit boring.
Right. So what did you think of the submissions overall?
I mean, it was pretty amazing and overwhelming. I think there are over 70. It's like this game of telephone, in the sense you put this thing into the world and it comes back to you and endless permutations.
What was the most surprising bit you heard?
So the most surprising was actually a remix done by someone I know, a sound artist named Chris Wood, aka Ward the Cat, in London. And his was the most surprising because he, rather than just do a straight remix, he kind of took it a conceptual sound art direction. It was called the Carnival Mix. And so what he did, he took elements of the song, but sort of put them in this whole sound field.
Here we're hearing it.
Here we go. Yeah, with some field recordings, which I bet he recorded at the Notting Hill Carnival. So almost this effect of hearing our song, but in as you're walking through London City with sound systems playing nearby and, you know, bits of other songs. It's almost...
it's kind of cool.
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty interesting what he did. So there's this big sense of space,
yeah,
and distance, and it's all a little bit disorienting. He wasn't... yeah.
And I guess we didn't say you couldn't add things that you recorded yourself, so this counts.
Mm-hmm.
But was there something else that struck you as out there or interesting?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's funny, one of the ones that we were marveling at was there's a symphonic mix. And so what this person did was, Adam Bryce, or Burse, I believe, he took our song and then just added layers. He added a drum kit, he added new violin, guitar lines, and it keeps the melody line and the shape of the original, but it almost like supercharges it as if for a big movie soundtrack.
Yeah, that's big. That's a lot.
Absolutely. And you can, clearly a lot of time went into this. Seems like live recording of a number of instruments.
Really?
So, yeah, that's what I'm guessing.
Wow. So, on to the winners, what you determined were the two best. Who's your runner-up?
So the runner-up is the group called The Lows and the Highs. And they kind of took, you know, the original song is sort of melancholy or introspective, and they decided to push it more in that direction by making kind of ambient sound field based around that. But really detailed, textural work. And interestingly enough, these guys, they did this remix entirely with freely available software. Open source stuff. There's a really interesting...
did you give them extra credit for that?
Yep, extra credit points. Actually, I only found that afterwards, because first I was listening.
So you didn't. So just on its own terms, this was the second best one you heard. Now, this is called Time Stretch Remix?
Yes.
What does that mean? Is that a term of art?
It's a musical term, actually. You can take a little snippet of sound and then literally lengthen it while the pitch remains the same. And so you can use that to create more drone-like tones and sort of, you know, smear a sound into a texture.
And it's so interesting that so far, these three that we've played, they are so distinct. You almost wouldn't imagine, unless you're you, that they all have the same DNA.
Yes, yeah. And so that's each one is a good remix. They took it far from where it began.
And the winner is...
Drum roll. The Phoenix Brothers.
Had you known of them before?
Nope, never heard of them. It turns out they're from Tulsa. And yeah, they've just really, really went into it. They completely reimagined the whole piece, used a new drum beat, sampled various bits of the melodies and the instruments, but each one is, they would add their own melodies. Very, very complete work, and a very contemporary kind of dance floor sound, dubstep, hip-hop related. And they didn't incorporate the vocals, which was a surprising move. I believe the cello sound is pitched up and turned into this sort of rumbling bass line. Here they've cut up the banjo into a new melody line. There's some synth sounds that we use in the original, which wash in.
So these and the other people whose remixes we played, it seems as though they spent a lot of time.
I think so, yeah.
Let's call them up and tell them they're the winners. Hi, is that JMA?
Yeah.
Hi, this is Kurt Anderson at Studio 360. How are you?
Good. How you doing, man?
Good. Thanks so much for entering this remix contest. As I think our producers told you that you're one of the finalists, yeah?
Yeah, I was super excited.
Well, maybe you'll be more super excited now because actually you guys are the winners.
Are you kidding me?
I am not kidding you.
That's freaking awesome. Wow.
And I've got Jace Clayton, DJ Rupture, here with me to tell you why he liked your remix.
Yeah. Oh, hell yeah. Awesome.
Hey, Phoenix Brothers and JMA. Yeah, great work, guys.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to remix it. I mean, all the stems were out of this world, great quality. I mean, outstanding.
Nice, yeah. And I feel like you guys really went in there and kind of took full use of those stems. Like, I hear all sorts of different samples, and each one is completely flipped. And the fact that you guys are writing new melodies and then crafted this, like, sick beat underneath it... really playing with the time and taking the mood into a different direction. Yeah, great work.
Yeah, you nailed it. Exactly what we tried to do is, you know, I wanted to keep the essence of what you made because, like I said, everything was great from the get-go. I just wanted to take it and just, as you said, flip it and just did exactly that.
I want to ask you, is there a thriving DJ remix culture in Tulsa?
Actual producers, not so much. It's coming up little by little, and as we're getting out there and we're DJing, getting around them, we're trying to help our community and anybody that pretty much comes up and say, hey, let's make a song, we're down to do it.
When you're not making music and DJing, what do you do? How do you earn a living?
I'm a graphic designer by trade. I'm actually right now in the middle of a... video shooting some B footage.
Well, I'll let you get back to it since that's what pays the bills.
Yep,
thanks a lot.
Got to pay the bills. Thank you.
It's actually kind of great to see people excited to engage with something and take it in so many different directions. You know, because obviously making a song turns into a very specific thing. And so it's a different look when you see all these strange reflections.
Yes, exactly. DJ Rupture, thank you very much once again for managing this and allowing this to happen.
Oh, thank you, Kurt. It's been great.
And thanks to everyone who submitted their 70-some remixes. You can listen to the winning tracks at studio360.org and, in fact, all 70 remixes on our SoundCloud page. Coming up, the novelist Susanna Moore on what a writer is supposed to do.
The writer's job is to make alive those things which most of us are not accustomed to experience every day.
Susanna Moore on her new novel, The Life of Objects. That's just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Susanna Moore's novel In the Cut, about a young woman in New York City who walks too far over on the wild side, is her best-known book, partly because Jane Campion turned it into a movie starring Meg Ryan and Mark Ruffalo.
You friends with Avery?
Do I know you?
Detective Malloy.
There was a homicide last Saturday. The deceased was seen in a red turtle the same night that you were there.
But Susanna Moore has written novels about young women growing up in the rustic dreamscape of her native Hawaii, and women in prison, and English ladies in colonial India. And she's not just wide-ranging on the page. Over the last few years, she's lived in Calcutta and Dublin and Japan and a half dozen other exotic places. Her new novel is called The Life of Objects, and she's here with me now, Susanna Moore. Welcome back to Studio 360.
Thank you, Kurt.
So, as I indicate in that introduction, your novels sort of hopscotch across time and space. What made you settle on World War II Germany?
I was very interested by a very particular study done by a woman of her own life called Lolly Horseman, No Time for Tears, which was published in the 60s. She's dead now. And it was about her life with her husband, Freddie Horstmann, on their estate outside of Berlin during the war. And then that got me thinking.
So the basic story, for those who haven't yet read the book, is this aristocratic German sort of apolitical, well-bred, non-Nazi couple and this girl, this Irish girl who comes to work for them. Did you think, once you decided, okay, I'm going to write a novel set in Germany in World War II, that this is such well-trodden territory that I better be careful not to seem too familiar?
Yes, I was very worried about that. And when I was writing the book, I was often overcome by a realization of my own naivete, which had not prepared me for all that was required. And I don't mean simply information. I knew I had to find a way to enter Germany, enter that world as an outsider, as someone, and even not only an outsider, but someone ignorant, as Beatrice is ignorant. She's very young, you know, 19.
Don't I recall knowing that your grandmother worked as a lady's maid?
Yes, yes. My grandmother was Irish, and as a girl, really for most of her life, worked as a lady's maid to a woman in Chestnut Hill in Philadelphia, and caused a lot of trouble, actually, for her daughters, particularly my mother, because it gave her ideas about class and behavior. And she molded my mother in this image, even to the point of dressing her in her mistress's hand-me-downs. Which,
as a child, really?
Well, no, as a young girl, and also it really is what attracted my father's attention, whose family was old Quaker Philadelphia. And I mean, it worked in the beginning. My father married her, but I think it was had a lot to do with her undoing as well, because she was pretending to be something that she wasn't.
You've taught creative writing to prison inmates, to GED students, to kids in shelters, all of which sounds like things that, you know, a young 26-year-old MFA would do, trying to scrape together a few dollars. Why do you do it as a major American novelist?
I will scrape together a few dollars. There's no pay for these jobs. Why do I do it? I suppose in psychological terms it has to do with my mother's death when I was a child and a sense that I, or a compulsion really, to do what I can to help, to keep someone alive, I suppose. But also it's, in a selfish way, it's really, really interesting and exciting. I mean, my students in prison are so provocative, interesting, stimulating.
And is teaching those people how to write entirely different from, for instance, as you've done for the last few years, teaching Princeton undergraduates how to write?
Yes, it is different. Because my students in prison or the young men I teach who are often just out of prison, I don't have them write fiction. I have them write their autobiographies, which is hard for them because in their culture, you don't talk too much about what's happened, as they frequently say to me, why do you want us to put our business in the street? And then I say, you're not putting it in the street. You're just doing it for me and for your fellow writers. So there's a resistance to that. And also for many of them, there's lack of knowledge. They don't often know very much about their parents. They don't know too much. Some don't even know when they were born.
And when you sit down with a fresh class of eager, high-achieving Princeton kids, what is there some mirror image set of problems they have in writing about themselves?
No, you know, of course, they know far too much about themselves. And they are accustomed to thinking about themselves and their own cosmologies and stories. And they're very familiar with all of that. And also, you know, now parents are talking to children about everything. And so my Princeton students, they don't know very much about literature, perhaps, but they do know a lot about themselves.
A decade ago, after this enormous success of In the Cut, were you tempted at that moment to say, wow, this really worked. I'm going to become a kind of genre writer of erotic thrillers?
I had the completely opposite reaction, which is I never want to write another sex scene and haven't, as you may notice. No, I was so what I did not want to become. And also for a long time, I think it was expected of me. So that whenever I was asked to write an article or give a talk, it was always on something like garter belts or sex as power. I was quite horrified by that. You know, no one was asking me to write about Smollett or Fielding, but about sex.
And then you published a novel about a women's prison, and probably people thought, oh, women's prison. But once again, you didn't satisfy the prurient interest.
Well, I suppose there is sex in that book, but mm-hmm. not at all like In the Cut. And also, people have said to me that when they read In the Cut, they kept looking at my photograph on the back. It was a bit unnerving.
And once was enough.
The character is not me.
Yeah.
Once was enough, yes. I learned my lesson.
Susanna Moore, thank you very much.
Thank you, Kurt.
Susanna Moore's new novel, The Life of Objects, is just out. To close the show today, we'll hear about the work of art that changed one young writer's life. The story begins in 1975, at the end of the Vietnam War, just as the North Vietnamese rolled into Saigon. Quang Bao was just 6 years old, but he remembers it vividly.
Everything in that time in my family is in the context of bodies fleeing, bodies flailing, bodies dying, bodies falling.
He and his family were among the refugees who escaped Vietnam that year and made it to the United States.
We lived in a refugee camp until we were sponsored by a Lutheran church in York, Pennsylvania. And then my family moved south to Sugarland, Texas, which is pretty much where I grew up. I went to a high school that was named after the governor, Samuel Clemens, so Clemens High School. We were the Rangers. It was very important because football was a very big thing at the school. And I was in the government, and I was captain of the swim team, and I had just a bunch of people in my life. But I didn't really have a friend in high school. So in that sense, high school became a very alienating experience. It really did feel like I was performing my life more than I was actually having one. I was seen as a very good student, but I actually performed poorly in certain subjects. And I failed my English class, and I was forced to stay behind for 6 weeks to take a remedial tutorial. It was so upsetting because the teacher just gave us this big packet of more stuff that I thought I would fail. I don't think I had the patience for literature. I thought novels were too long. I thought plays should be seen, even though I never saw any. And quite frankly, when you're a boy, you don't talk about poetry aloud, really, not with any sensitivity. So even the few things that I could extract from poems, I wasn't brave enough to really say. I was slumped in my chair. I was hating myself just because I didn't want to be there. And really, it was the first poem on the page of the packet. And I hadn't heard of E.E. Cummings before. And I was so intrigued by the lower casing. I think that was the first sort of compelling thing. I thought, this looks really strange. And I was looking on the page, and, you know, he does a lot of punctuation, experimentation, line breaks. And it took only that for me to sort of focus and try to pay attention. The poem's called I Like My Body When It Is With Your. I like my body when it is with your body. It is so quite new a thing. Muscles better and nerves more. I like your body. I like what it does. I like its hows. I like to feel the spine of your body and its bones and the trembling, firm smoothness in which I will again and again and again kiss. I like kissing this and that of you. I like slowly stroking the shocking fuzz of your electric fur, and what is it comes, overparting flesh, and eyes big love crumbs. And possibly I like the thrill of under me you so quite new. I never thought a poem could be sexy. And sometimes in my head I flip the first line so that it reads, when it is with your body, I like my body. And that's the reciprocal nature of love. We love our lovers, and our lovers love us back. And then the last line for me, of under me, you, it seems to suggest what lovemaking is about, which is that once you have that other love, it's just all one big tumble. At the same time, when I was young, I already started feeling myself being much more attracted to the boys in the class. Like I would put my hand on somebody's shoulder, and it felt to me like something that was very willful from my body. But I knew better than the fact that in Sugarland, Texas, you shouldn't act out on it. So then I censored myself. And so when I think about the compliments of my life being this Vietnamese person as well as this gay person, I could not have the proper environment in which both of these things could easily come out. So part of what this poem meant for me was the idea that somehow I would be in love and that someone would love me back was a profound revelation. I read more on my own. I think it was the very, very first library book I ever checked out was a collection of poems by E.E. Cummings in which this poem is included. And I moved to Boston, went to Boston University, and in Boston I found my independence and my first boyfriend. I like my body when it is with your body. It is so quite new a thing. Muscles better and nerves but more. But being in your body, giving love through your body, and getting love back through your body is something that I think is greater than just romantic love relationships. I like kissing this and that of you. I've seen it where parents will kiss different parts of their infant or toddler's body parts. And I love your nose, and then they kiss their nose, and I love your mouth, and they kiss their mouth. And eyes big love crumbs. It's a lesson as much as it is like a transmission of real love. The most recent experience I had with this poem was actually when my father died. He died September 27, 2008 from colon cancer. And the very last time I saw my father, he wasn't able to speak. So I told my mother that I would take one of the night shifts for her. And then I just sort of went into bed with my dad and held his hand. And at that point, I could no longer speak to my dad because so much of my relationship with my father is a dialogue. We spoke a lot, and it seemed unfair to me that I would just be the one talking and he could never respond. So I was holding my father's hand, and I said, okay, well, I'm just going to sort of squeeze it, and physically, I said, I love you. And I said, I miss you, and I want you to stay. And I want to be next to your body. I want your body here. I want you with me. And I knew it. I knew that line had come, and I had internalized it, and I was sharing it with him. That poem for me is about the transmission of love. And life's project is finding, getting, giving love.
Quang Bao is a writer living in New York City. Studio 360's Jenny Lawton produced our story. Has a poem ever changed your life, or a painting, or a TV show, or a book? If so, drop us a note at studio360.org, and we might put your story on the air. That's it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen again next time. If you want to keep up with us during the week, you can follow us on Twitter at Studio360Show. You can also find me on Twitter at KB Anderson. That is Anderson with an E. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Alana Harper, Julia Barton,
Mujahid Solomon,
Julia Wetherill,
Alina Kuczynski,
Matt Liebowitz,
Jesse Taylor.
Thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. And by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, The Satanic Verses was a worldwide bestseller, but its author spent almost a decade hiding from the Ayatollah Khomeini's executioners. I'll talk with Salman Rushdie about his new memoir next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.